Hello and welcome back to Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the show where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I'm Steve and I'm here as always with my co-hosts, Patrick.
Hello.
And Chris.
Hey!
And we're doing something we haven't done in quite a while. We're watching a film that came out before the year 2015. We're watching 1974's Larry Cohen film, his first horror film, It's Alive. But before we get into it, we always like to do a little bit of a horror catch-up and see what we've been experiencing in the horror space outside of our homework for today. Chris, why don't you go first?
So I actually have things this time. Well, first of all, I watched Freeway.
Hell yeah!
A very lurid, terrible exploitation film that just made me laugh the entire runtime, and legitimate. It's always weird. You watch these horrible, grimy, low budget movies and it's all filth and bullshit. But then like there's a 15 to 20 minute stretch where you're like, oh, there's Academy Award shit happening here.
Oh, Reese Witherspoon gives an Academy Award performance in that film. She's so good.
She does. And I hear she's like disowned the movie, but because it's not very on brand for her.
I feel like that movie, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I feel like there's got to be some, well, it's definitely a heaping helping of misogyny, probably some racism, probably some homophobia, maybe even trans. Like, it's one of those movies where it's like every line is meant to offend, and yet somehow I laugh my ass off.
Yeah, and those two things aren't mutually exclusive, but I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed Kiefer Sutherland as the creep who picks up Reese Witherspoon on the side of the road and earns her trust and has disgusting intentions.
Bob Wolverton.
And that's just the start of it. Anyway, I also went to the movie house and saw Lisa Frankenstein.
Ooh.
Mm.
Lisa Frankenstein, the new movie, the directorial debut of Zelda Williams, the daughter of Robin Williams, written by Diablo Cody of Juno and Jennifer's Body fame and other stuff that you guys probably like more than those movies.
No, those are the highlights.
And it was fine. It was fine. It was cute. I had a smile on my face for, I would say, most of the runtime, but at the end of the day, I thought it was really kind of disorganized and kind of pulling in different directions, and there was a lot of stuff going on, and it didn't come together in the end. So I will say it was okay, but kind of made me sad that there was some talent on display, obviously from like Diablo Cody and obviously from Catherine Newton from Freaky, who plays the main character. They were great. The production designer was great. Zelda Williams, let's give her a couple more pictures, because I was not impressed with the direction in this thing. It was all like the whole movie was shot for coverage, as they say. There's two people talking. It's like, here's the wide shot. Here's the over the shoulder. Here's the over the shoulder. They
maybe walk in
the next room. We do it again.
Maybe let's not give her a couple more pictures if she did not display any talent.
Well, you know, not everyone hits it out of the park on their first try. That's all I got. Patrick.
Speaking of hitting it out of the park or not on your first try, I've been continuing on work on my horror short comic, which I'm looking forward to sharing with folks and getting some hopefully constructive thoughts on how well I did on my first try in probably a couple months here. Outside of that, not much. I wrapped up True Detective Night Country and thought that had a really nice finish that didn't necessarily go the sort of supernatural way that we were thinking it might, but I really liked the ending anyways, kind of a big twist in the final episode that was very, it was just fun. It was a fun twist, honestly. Bleak as it was.
Remember when I promised you that I would follow that week to week?
Yeah. You haven't watched a single episode, have you?
I haven't watched a single episode.
I didn't think so.
You know, that might be the way. Sorry to jump in on this, because that's on my list to talk about, too. That might be the way to go about it, Chris, because I was I found the ending interesting. Like, I liked the twist, but there was such a buildup to this being something far crazier than what actually happens. And the way that they come about discovering the twist, I found to be so kind of boneheaded. You know, Jodie Foster has this whole thing throughout the whole series, which is, you know, ask me a question. And then, so of course, there's this dramatic moment where she realizes, oh, we've been asking the wrong questions. Well, and the question she asks, I'm not spoiling it, but the question she asks is so fucking basic that it would be like at the, they would be the second bullet point on any investigation into this. I still liked what ended up happening. I thought it was cool. I thought it was kind of vindicating for some of the community that this film deals with, but it's not what I was hoping for.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I still enjoyed it overall. It didn't necessarily knock my socks off, I guess, but it was enjoyable. I don't know. I feel like it suffers again from the contemporary prestige TV thing where even for a short series like this is relatively short in like the context of, you know, the peak TV age at 6 episodes. But it still felt a little stretched to me. Like maybe it's 4 episodes or something. I don't know. It felt a little overlong and a lot of like sort of build up to what, you know, maybe even could have been a movie or something. I don't know. But overall, you know, I'm nitpicking. I enjoyed it for the most part. Great atmosphere, great performances, and, you know, a compelling, finish to the whole mystery. Even if I do agree, as you said, like the way they get to learning what actually happened is a little, boneheaded, maybe the right word.
Yeah, it's I kind of interrupted my own train of thought too, Chris. What I was saying is this might be the best way to go about it is just to binge it, which is what I kind of wish I had just stayed out of the discourse on this one and waited until it was finished to watch it over like an afternoon or 2 days, because the atmosphere is so rich that it feels like it would benefit from like really sinking your teeth in and spending prolonged periods of time in this world. And I might have even picked up more connections that I didn't otherwise, that I might have missed because of the week-to-week nature and just how many characters there are in this and how many little details and threads back to the first season there are. So I'll be curious to hear what you think if you choose to go the binge route.
Well, discourse is the joy killer.
It is.
Yeah, I was completely out of the discourse for this one, as I am on most things these days. And it is, I don't know, it's just a more enjoyable way to take these things in, I think.
It was hard for me to avoid, and I didn't get too deep into it, because honestly, most of the discourse was rooted in misogyny. Mm. A lot of people were like, you know, even though nobody talks about seasons 2 and 3 of True Detective, they were acting like, you know, those are precious along with season 1, and this woman coming in with these 2 female cops is really fucking up the energy. And that's disgusting. And not only that, but Nick Pizzolatto, the creator, weighed in on this and called the show stupid multiple times and just said some
That was crazy,
really
that's
sick weird. Shitty stuff that I'm like, dude, your name is on this. You're collecting a paycheck from this. Do you ever want to work with HBO, you know, a big streamer again?
Yeah, isn't he? I mean, he's still an executive producer, I think, right?
Yeah. Huh.
That's bizarre.
Pretty wild stuff. So if you were able to avoid it, hats off to you, because it's really kind of sickening. Mm. There are problems with the show, and the fact that a woman created it is not one of those problems. Mm-hmm.
What else have you been watching besides True Detective, Steven?
I watched Eli Roth's Thanksgiving.
It's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix.
I assume you watched it on Netflix.
I didn't, actually. It came in, it, like, this happens with every new release. It came in at the library the day before it was supposed to be on Netflix on Blu-ray, and I wanted to watch it with a friend who was going on vacation the next day, so we just stayed up late and watched it. I had a fucking hoot with this. It's so, so funny. I mean, I had tears in my eyes multiple times. I'm not a big slasher guy, but like this movie gets what can be fun about slashers, you know, with the quirky characters, interesting twists, though I did guess the killer like 5 minutes into the movie, even though there were moments where I thought maybe I was wrong, but that's not even a problem. That's a feature, not a bug, because the payoff is still pretty fun. And the kills, like, I'm not one for gore, but if you can make me laugh and scream at the same time with the shot of someone's mutilated body, then you're doing your job right. And if there's anything Eli Roth knows how to do, it's that. So this, I look forward to this being a part of my horror Thanksgiving tradition along with Blood Rage every year. Double feature, baby. I don't think it gets any better than that for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. It's completely, it was very in one ear, out the other with me. Like, I enjoyed it, and then I don't think I thought a goddamn thing about it like an hour later, but I would definitely go back to it, particularly at Thanksgiving time.
That metaphor is apt for one particular kill that I really enjoyed.
In one ear and out the other.
Might have been the biggest laugh for me, actually. All right, so that's what we've been up to outside of our homework. Yeah, we're talking about It's Alive from 1974. Interesting thing right off the bat, I may have mentioned this at the end of the last episode, but Netflix has suddenly decided, you know, they're definitely not scared about losing subscribers because they've suddenly decided that they're going to put some care into curating their catalog. And they're doing this thing this year where every month they're releasing movies from different decades ago. So, you know, they started with 74, 40 years ago. I think this month they have a bunch of movies, classics from 1984, and so on and so forth, which is just totally bizarre to me that they've suddenly decided to care to include older content. I don't even know how much of a demand there is for it among Netflix users, but I was delighted to see this pop up because I'm a big Larry Cohen fan, and somehow, even though this is one of his most famous movies, I had never seen it. So, perfect opportunity for us to do something a little different and me to catch up on something that I'd missed. This is a film about a couple expecting their second child, and that child turns out to be quite a monster. Yes, we've seen it before. Yes, it was called Rosemary's Baby, but...
Very different. Very different.
Very different, but this, I think, was seen as kind of a cheap knockoff of that at the time it came out. And yeah, it goes in a very different direction, has very different... politics in some ways, but yeah, they literally the mother literally gives birth to a monster that kills all the staff in the operating room and escapes the hospital and goes on a rampage.
Yeah,
and that's the first. I mean, that's in the first 15 or 20 minutes. So unlike Rosemary's Baby, which is like 2.5 hours of slow burn pregnancy and then ooh, spooky. This is. Immediately we get the spooky and the monster is on the loose, and that's the movie. And
yeah, because Rosemary's Baby, I think, ends with her giving birth,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah,
I saw, I think on the Wikipedia, there's a little quote from a review at the time that describes it as some kind of, you know, like a trashy sequel to Rosemary's Baby. It's like Rosemary's Baby 2, like what happens when the baby is born and goes out and does fucking demon shit in the world.
Well, that's The Omen.
Yeah.
But this is a great okay so who is Larry Cohen? This guy, he directed a lot of TV, I think, in the 60s and early 70s. He then transitioned to making, oddly enough, blaxploitation movies. He's a white man. He made Black Caesar and Hell Up in Harlem. Actually, he made Hell Up in Harlem at the same time he was making this, and he decided to make a horror movie. He came up with this punchy concept, and he traditionally wrote and directed his own films, and he was kind of like a Roger Corman-esque DIY madman working at the lowest possible rung in the studio system. And his movies are just go for broke. There's something interesting in every shot, even if it doesn't work for the movie as a whole. It feels like actors are improvising. There's odd details. There's funny lines of dialogue. Action is constantly happening. And that's been true of all the other films I've seen of his, like the Maniac Cop movies and The Stuff, which I know Patrick is a fan of.
Wait a minute.
Cue the Winged Serpent.
Larry Cohen didn't do Maniac Cop.
He wrote them.
Oh, okay.
I don't think he directed any of them, but when you know, you know. Because you can tell he wrote those movies because they're like this. They're like, I can't believe the words that are coming out of characters' mouths in these scenes. And he's kind of shoehorning in, you know, his sort of politics you know, discussion topics of the era that this was made. And, you know, this movie runs the gamut from talking about the environment to abortion to you name it. I'm curious about initial impressions of this movie because it really, like, I think within the first 5 minutes, you probably have a good idea of whether or not you're along for the ride.
I really liked I was charmed by the movie initially. Just, I mean, it's refreshing to watch a movie from the 70s for this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I liked the aesthetic, and I liked how much time was spent on just little character stuff, and the father taking care of the kid, and then they go to the hospital and they have a little family chat in the car, which are other pretty stock scenes. But then, like, he goes to the hospital and he has to hang out in the waiting room with, like, I guess all these other expectant fathers.
They're just playing cards like you do.
Yeah, they're playing cards and smoking. And even before that, like, he gets to the hospital and he's talking to the nurse, and it's just very naturalistic dialogue where he's talking about, like, whether she speaks Gaelic and how he's Irish and stuff. And yeah, it's like very incidental to the plot, but the kind of stuff that, like, you would never see Chris Evans doing in a movie today. and so it was refreshing, and so I was drawn into that. My first impression of the baby, I did not care much for the baby horror in this film. I kind of liked the movie in spite of the baby horror, but the main premise didn't really do the trick for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I was very into the stuff. It did have that, like, yeah, go for broke energy that you're describing, and I was very into that, and I was excited for this as a result. But I don't know, this didn't really give me the same vibe. It felt actually a bit slow to me. I was like, okay, mutant baby movie, I guess I just want more kind of, like, I don't know, Miles to Gallon or something than I wound up getting out of this. I don't know. It was a little sleepy to me. And also, you mentioned the politics, and I guess that also felt a little haphazard to me, especially compared to the stuff, which seems to be making, perhaps simplistic, but still very consistent and cogent point on consumerism. But this was just kind of all over the place, like throwing a little reference to birth control and throwing a little reference to pollution. It didn't really seem like there was an overall point other than kind of stirring the pot a little bit. So I guess, yeah, I don't know. Overall impression, maybe a little underwhelmed, actually.
There's a lot going on in it, and I agree, it doesn't congeal into a cohesive whole. Like, especially when, like, when the fathers are hanging out in the waiting room, you know, they're talking about smog and pollution, and one of them's an exterminator.
Rats or roaches or something.
He talks about, you know, like, they found out how to kill roaches, and then they just, like, a new kind of roach was born that was unkillable. Which, you know, of course, they're talking about this baby, but then I'm like, what does this movie have to say about babies, then?
Yeah, the movie seems to take... It seems to take a dim view of abortion, I think, because of that exchange with the exterminator, and because there's the part where, like, I think it's the police or something, they're like, did you consider abortion? And he's like, everybody considers it these days. Yeah. It's like, is that true? Does everybody, every pregnant couple, consider abortion if they're, like, trying to have a baby? So I don't know. That did seem haphazard to me. I just kind of decided I would take my own interpretation of it, which is just, like, sort of the movie, sort of a distillation of the idea of, like, why would you bring a child into this world?
Right, which felt to me so timely in a way.
Yeah, and then here's a child who comes into the world and he's pissed about it, basically.
Well, Larry Cohen has said that his, like, initial idea for this movie was something like, you know, how babies seem so, like, distraught. They're constantly crying and screaming and you know, like, upset about what they've been brought into, and, like, what if they could bite back? That's a fun idea for a B movie. I don't know.
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Why not?
Another thing I really appreciate is how – so the baby comes out of the baby gets delivered and kills
everyone.
At least 5 doctors, maybe as many as 10, effortlessly.
Yeah. Well, we don't even see it happen. It just seems to happen instantaneously, right? We just see the aftermath.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of the baby in general until, like, the very end, frankly.
And something I liked is there's absolutely no, like, real investigation. There's no X-Files moment where they're like, what did this to these doctors? Everyone knows immediately this baby is a monster that killed everybody. And we gotta move on from there. We didn't have to spend any time trying to figure out or explain the premise of the movie that we already know. They're just like, yeah, it's a monster baby. Let's go get it.
Well, and frankly, there's really no investigation as far as, like, explaining why the baby is the way it is. I mean, there's kind of certainly a hefty gesture in the direction that this may be a side effect of the mom's birth control, but it's kind of unclear as to if that's, like, actually the explanation for it or not.
Well, we could maybe get into that in the spoiler room. Not that I have answers for you, but the movie definitely does gesture toward that. While we're still in the hospital, I mean, even before the killing, an example of the dialogue in this movie. This made me laugh my fucking ass off. So, you know, they're gonna have to pull the baby out. She can't deliver it. The doctor just says so casually, "This baby's gigantic, but she's got a good, she's got a big pelvis, and she's willing to cooperate." And he just delivers this so ridiculously casually, and there are lines like that like every 5 minutes in this movie where it's like no human being would ever speak this way, but it almost feels like it was written for comedic effect. Mm-hmm. She's got a big pelvis and she's willing to cooperate. What does that even mean?
I remember that exchange. I think I missed the willing to cooperate bit. I don't know. It's weird sometimes how I process things. I process humor, because a lot of the time I think I don't pick up on it. I don't know. It's some quirk of my brain. But I just like was like, oh, yeah, it's a big baby. It's 11 pounds. I just kind of like let it go. Whoop.
And also, with this being an old movie, it's a little hard to tell what's period vernacular and what's not.
Mm.
I mean, there's a one section where they have an exchange about babies being retarded.
Oh, I wrote that down too.
Matter of fact, in ways that where they're just describing the vernacular of the time, but yeah.
But there's okay. We'll get to that scene because I had to pause the movie because I was losing my mind. I'm like, okay, obviously this isn't a term we use anymore. But what that character is trying to convey to the father is kind of fucked up. So I did feel justified in laughing at it, but we'll talk about it. That was a great scene.
But yeah, I mean, it's I don't even really know how to describe this movie. It's like almost, I don't think satire is the right word, but there's something going on where we follow the father and the movie doesn't seem as interested in the baby as you might think. And a lot of the drama is about what's going on with the father and how he's perceiving the situation, how he's relating to his wife, and how the world is persecuting him because he fathered this fucked up baby.
Yeah, but that really is the journey, and like him, at a certain point, like he's trying to make a decision for himself about whether or not he even believes this to be his child, or whether or not he is just going to, you know, reject that notion outright and join the police in trying to find it and destroy it.
Yeah, and I mean, it's, I don't know, it's an interesting character too, because the father was just kind of like a piece of shit to me. I feel like you were actually supposed to process him as a piece of shit too. And then there's some very interesting things that happen with that character later in the movie that I guess we'll get into in the spoiler room. But I was a little surprised, I guess, at his arc, ?
Maybe I'm a piece of shit because I didn't read him as a piece of shit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, what did he do that was shitty?
Well, I mean, he's making deals to sell the baby's corpse off for fucking research. He gets involved in the hunt for the baby. He's an asshole to his wife. He's an asshole to his wife all the time. Like, he's constantly trying to like shut down and gaslight his wife. Mm. I don't know. There was almost nothing up until the very end of the movie that told me this guy isn't a piece of shit, honestly.
I mean, he's okay. He gets from the beginning of the movie, he's like likable, bordering on annoying, because he's doing like, Chris, you're talking about the you know, can you speak Gaelic scene. He's going into this like, oh my God, I'm having a baby. And suddenly he's like talking in a dorky old man voice to his kid in the car when they go to take him to the uncle's house. You know, he's like kind of endearing. He's like very excited about this pregnancy and about having a second child. But then understandably, his life fucking falls apart and he starts to like question everything and he starts to lose it a little bit, which I sort of sympathized with on some levels. He made some questionable decisions, but this is clearly a man who's under a lot of pressure because, well, he works for a public relations firm. Mm-hmm. And he gets fired in the most passive aggressive fucking way possible, in a great scene. But, that just kicks off how, like, he can't even, like, go out into, he can't talk to anybody without them knowing that he and his wife birthed this monster baby.
Yeah. Because he gets, I mean, the media exposes him. Mm-hmm. He gets doxxed.
They name him, yeah.
And yeah, so everyone wants him. I think we're supposed to like him because, you know, we see him get kicked a few times. He has his little save the cat moment where he gives the guy quarters back for the cigarette machine that ate his quarters.
Yeah. Oh, he also has I struggled with what to call this. It's not a save the cat moment. It's just a cute cat moment in the very beginning of the movie when he has to go wake his son up. The son is sleeping, which I think that's actually Larry Cohen's cat. The most docile, sweet little creature I've ever seen on film. The son is sleeping with the cat in his arms, and the dad, to wake him up, like, picks the cat up and starts, like, rubbing it against his head and getting it to lick him to gently. And I'm like, that's such a cute thing. Like, what a nice dad.
Mm-hmm.
Like this guy. It's good with animals.
Nice, I don't know. It was fun to see a movie that just has little touches like that. I mean, you don't have to like this guy, but I did like little moments like that. I feel like you don't see that stuff in a lot of movies these days.
No, that's a totally 70s thing, I feel like, where there's just like, yeah, weird little touches that probably weren't even in the script. It's just like in the moment, the actor is like, you know, it'd be really like more endearing of the character if I did this. And you have a cat that behaves well. Let's see how she does on camera. I don't know. But the killing rampage ensues.
This movie's basically like Jaws with a baby. I think that's what they were going for. You don't see much of the baby that's out there. I don't know. It had Jaws vibes to me, but maybe I'm doing the thing where it's like man who's only seen the boss baby getting boss baby vibes from every movie.
Well, okay, so when did Jaws come out? Because this technically...
73?
76?
75.
Yeah.
75. Oh, so it came out after this. So Jaws has It's Alive vibes.
Oh, really? All right. Well, I think we just exposed one Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, so I read that you initially, Cohen did not want to show the baby at all. And then he ended up deciding to hire Rick Baker, of all people. Well, I mean, he probably wasn't a big name then.
Rick Baker, the monster maker,
to make the baby. And his idea, Larry Cohen's idea is like, well, you know, he wasn't envisioning a puppet. He's like, maybe you could make something that like, you know, a costume my cat could wear, or maybe a chicken, maybe two chickens. and then it progressed to, I don't know, I kind of liked the baby. We see it very briefly in a few scenes, and I thought it was pretty creepy. And I liked that it had a little tiny bit of life to it in the moments that we saw it.
It's just a puppet, right? There's not like anyone or anything inside.
For some of it, somebody was in it. And I can't remember. It was like somebody's on the production's wife or something, but they made like a full-size suit that she could wear.
There are a couple shots where it looks like an actor on like a giant set crawling around.
Like in the school, probably, where it's like crawling under tables and stuff.
Yeah.
I liked it. It was good. So. It gave me some chills and thrills.
Did it, though? Because it's... I that's kind of where I am with this because it's not very chilling. It's not very thrilling. The human elements are interesting. But I don't know. Anytime this movie was like, here's some baby horror, didn't really turn the dial for me, sadly.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know what? Maybe we should review it and we'll go down and we'll talk about some of the kills. We'll talk about, you know, where this goes, how it wraps up. Because I'm kind of with you and I'm kind of not like for it's like this is a movie where I had to set my expectations accordingly. It's Larry Cohen. His movies are always a mess. I mean, I love him, but not because he's a polished filmmaker. His stuff is just like usually kind of gonzo and weird and, you know, taped together and glued together. And I like the roughness around the edges, especially because he seems sincere. He seems really smart, even though he can never seem to find focus in his movies, except for the stuff. I think I agree with Patrick. That has a pretty clear, though simple, message. But I would give this a cue. Like, I think if you like stuff that's rough around the edges, there's a lot of fun to be had here, just in the weird choices, the odd details, and just the scrappy nature of this movie. I never feel like it takes itself – if it ever takes itself too seriously, it generated a laugh from me. but like almost a laugh of like of admiration for somebody who could be so like, you know, open-hearted to think that this could actually scare people. But I liked it. I'm actually considering there's two sequels, and Shout Factory put out a box set, and I remember those the VHS cover of the third movie, Island of the Alive.
Island of the Alive.
Yeah. I remember that VHS cover from when I was a kid with the little bassinet on the beach and the claw creeping out, and I thought it looked like, you know, that's what I – it's like Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian for the It's Alive franchise. I want to see the other two movies in this franchise, so I liked it enough to say that. I'll give it a cue. Patrick?
I will also give it a cue-it. You know, obviously, as I said, it wasn't as, I expected like sort of crazier energy, and it just felt a little like stagnant, I guess, oddly to me, which seems like an odd thing to say about a movie that's about a mutant baby going on a killing rampage. But even at 90 minutes, it felt just kind of slow and a little uneventful to me. But it is still strange, I guess, in an interesting way. And if you want to check out, you know, kind of a weird low budget older creature feature, sure, you could do worse. Chris?
Yeah, I'll co-sign what you said, Patrick. I will give it a cue it. I think I already said what I liked about it. You know, I liked the time spent on character and sort of the atmosphere and how it kind of focused on the father more than the baby. But at the end of the day, you go see this movie to see the baby. And I don't think that the horror elements or the slasher elements, not interesting at all, other than the fact that it's a baby and there's a couple fun gags where it's like, oh, the baby wants milk. It's going to kill the milkman. there's stuff like that that makes you smile a little bit. But I didn't think this really worked as a thriller or a chiller, just as sort of a drama. But there's better dramas from the 1970s that you could watch. So cue it.
Throw out the baby, but keep the bathwater.
Right. Yeah, there were a few good dramas in the 1970s, like one or two. Well, hey, before we head on down to the spoiler milk truck, I will encourage you, as usual, to follow us on social media at Ehmoncast. That's EHMONcast. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and we love it when you interact with us on there and tell us about what you thought about the latest movies we've watched. We love it even more, actually, though, if you join our Discord community. There's a link in the show notes, and we have a wonderful group of folks from all over the world out there discussing both the movies that we review on the show and also all kinds of other awesome horror stuff. Steven's Book Club is out there. We just finished reading Out There Screaming, which actually we forgot to mention in Horror Catch-Up, Steven, but I've still been enjoying that collection of black horror stories edited by Jordan Peele. And what else? Go to our broken website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com. You can find our merch shop there and buy t-shirts and other goods and sundries with Amon art on them. And lastly, go to your podcast provider of choice, leave us a review. We love to see the feedback, and it helps people find the show.
Great. So we're going to go to the what spoiler place can we go for this? We're gonna go to the back of the spoiler milk truck.
The spoiler. What do they call those? The fucking like canyons that are in every those concrete canyons that are in every LA movie, like the fucking sewers.
Oh, that's the LA River, right?
LA. Oh, that's the LA River.
We're going to the spoiler LA River.
Shit.
It's a fucked up river. Spoil everything. It's a very fucked up river about It's Alive. We'll see you in a moment. All right, welcome back. We are lurking down in the LA riverbed, probably shooting without a permit. I don't know. We got every cop car in the city that we could find that was out of commission to chase down this mutant baby. We're going to spoil everything about It's Alive. I'm glad you brought up the LA River. That was one of my favorite parts of this movie. Just from, like, I found it so charming in that Larry Cohen like way where he's like, we don't have any fucking money, but we're going to make this look big. And it really did for that scene.
Yeah, and I mean, it's impressive that, like, the cop cars drive into the tunnels, which I don't know if that's something you can actually physically do at that location or if that was a separate location or set, but it looked very cool.
Yeah, and that's sort of, I guess, what the opening credits are, yeah, right?
The flashlights. Just like
little lights moving around, and it's the lights of all the cops in the tunnel.
That makes sense. It's, that was a cool opening visual.
It's kind of got like a Saul Bass vibe to it, and we haven't mentioned that Bernard Herrmann did the score for this.
What the fuck?
He did a lot of shit toward the end of his career, I think. You could get him... Yeah, I think De Palma... Not that De Palma's movies are shit, but you know... They're a little sketchy sometimes, but you could get them for a low fee. Good score, a little bit out of touch for 1974, I think. But you know, you can't go wrong. You've got Hitchcock's right hand man working with you.
Hell yeah!
I don't really know what to talk about in terms of spoilers. Obviously, the baby's gonna kill. It kills a lot of people, I guess, because there's kind of a hysteria about it. The cops are chasing it. University researchers are chasing it because they want to do a necropsy on this thing and figure out how it went bad. The infamous deal that the father makes.
Against the mother's will. The mother's not into that.
Yeah, but I can't really get my finger on the mother. What's her deal?
She wants her baby.
No.
She wants her baby.
Well, there's the woman seems very strange.
I mean,
postpartum depression.
Well,
is that what it is?
I just think it's the acting style of the time. I just, that struck me as like 70s performance of a mom, kind of the same way the dad to me struck me as 70s performance of kind of a just typical misogynistic dude. But obviously we all had different reads on the father. I don't know. The mom just struck me as kind of your typical quote unquote hysterical mom. But I was just like, she just wants her baby.
Yeah, she seems hysterical. She seems a little manic. She's taken pills at one point or given pills at one point, and I don't know if they're just sleeping pills or if they're something else. She seems a little bit like elated when the baby is lurking around in her house in a way that I couldn't figure out.
She winds up hiding the baby in the house.
Yeah. But I don't know. She just like, for someone who's going through something pretty traumatic, she seems very like sort of cheery in a weird and out of touch way.
Kind
of
manic, yeah.
For a few scenes here. And I couldn't figure out what they were trying to communicate.
So I thought she was trying to play like cool, calm, and collected a lot of the time. Like I thought a good example of this to me was, I think this is shortly after they come home from the hospital and she's literally setting the table for dinner, setting out two placemats for her and the dad. And he is like, honey, I'm going out, literally as she's about to put dinner on the table. And she's like, oh, yes, dear, I'm okay. And he's like, oh, are you sure you'll be all right by yourself? Oh, yeah, I'll be fine. And then like the minute he walks out the door, like the facade just drops, which, you know, to me is just like she, you know, knows shit is not right. She doesn't have much control over it, but she's going to try and put on the good face for the husband because there's not much else she can do, which I actually thought was a pretty well-played bit of the actress's performance.
More layers than I was expecting, I guess.
Yeah.
I didn't see them all.
Well, that's I kind of had wished I was able to see this movie twice before recording because there is a lot going on. It does also speak, the character stuff speaks to the very low budget nature too, because Cohen is smart enough to know there's not a lot I can really show in this movie. So I really need people to care about these characters and what's going on with them. He might have put a little too much energy into that because it does ultimately become kind of confusing across the board as to where your sympathies should lie with these people. It's like he let it stew for a little too long, and there's just too many ideas on screen that clash with each other.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I guess, you know, maybe this is jumping ahead too far to the literal very end, but that was what I was alluding to before that kind of threw me off with the dad, where I just thought his motivations were selfish and, again, sort of misogynistic, fairly careless about the baby. And then at the very last minute, he kind of seems to have a change of heart and attempts to protect the baby, I don't know, just kind of surprised me. I was like, where did this come from?
The whole movie, this guy is totally on. I mean, the cops are like not sure what to make of him, and he's like, oh no, you believe me, I want to kill this baby more than you want to kill this baby. Mm-hmm. Why? Maybe because he feels responsible. Maybe because he's being pilloried in the community for having given this baby. He hates the baby. Who knows? But he wants to kill his baby, and he damn well wants to do it himself too. He's walking around with the rifle. He's like, we don't call the police in my neighborhood. It's like,
we just go baby hunting.
If I see the baby, I shoot it. This house is protected by Smith and Wesson. But so yeah, and then there's this climactic scene where they're in the tunnels that are the drains leading to the LA River, and they're hunting baby, and we get a lot of just kind of cop cars in the sewer, footsteps in the sewer, and he's hunting with the pack of police, and he veers off and he hears baby noises. He's like, that sounds like my baby. Shines the light, sees the baby, and then at the last minute he's overcome with gentleness.
Eternal love.
Well, and it was such a sudden shift that when he first like started talking nicely to the baby and trying to like calm it down, I thought for sure he was gonna fucking murk it as soon as it let him get close enough. But no, he actually like has a change of heart that feels completely unmotivated. It's not really in the script, it's not really in the performance, and he attempts to save the baby, which does not work out well.
That's the thing about babies, though. They fuck with your pheromones. It's not motivated. You could be like, I hate babies, I never want to have a baby, and then you would have a baby and you'd be like, this thing, oh my god, this is the most important. And next thing you know, you're on Instagram, your whole page baby photos.
And you know this from when you had your first child?
No, I know this from watching everyone else I know do it. Including people who didn't want babies.
There's a line in this. Somebody says to the dad, like, people who don't have kids, they don't know how lucky they are. Kids are definitely seen as a curse in this. And as exemplified by the screenshot that I shared with you guys last night, where the cops are going through a neighborhood looking for the baby, tapping on the crawl space entrances, and covering half the frame is a bus that says "Stop Children."
I thought that was an ice cream truck, wasn't it?
Ice cream truck, whatever it is. It's a vehicle. It's a van.
Yeah. That scene did yield a funny, I mean, probably both the funniest and most genuinely shocking moment in the movie for me is when they think they've got the mutant baby cornered, and it's actually just like a perfectly normal, cute little baby, like sitting on the front lawn of this house, and it's surrounded by cops, like training their guns on it. Put your hands up, motherfucker, kind of moment. That was probably the best moment in the movie for me, honestly.
But like, why is the baby just playing in the dirt by itself?
Why not just have him shoot the baby, though?
Well, I mean, that would be pretty fucked up.
It'd be too far. It'd be too much.
That would be too far. Baby. That would be too far for me. Yeah.
If they just cut to black and you heard the gunshot, and then there's the police chief, and he was like, it's so fucked up what we did. Oh my God. Oh my God.
Yeah, I don't need the baby to be shot. But that goes back to our age-old divide on I think our biggest, most fundamental difference is whether about babies dying or kids dying. Babies dying or pets dying in movies.
Can we get the cargo baby in there instead?
Shoot the cargo baby. Unload your weapons, man. I forgot the cat gets it in this too. And a pretty
cat. I know when you said it's Larry Cohen's actual cat, I was gonna say R.I.P. but that would have been a spoiler.
he killed his cat for cinema. Yeah,
it looks like a real corpse to me. That thing was flayed.
You know, one time. I don't know how to tell this story. One time as a kid, we had like there were dead cats in the garage one summer. And we were like, well, did we like accidentally close the door or something? But the cats were like, they were flayed out and like separated limb from limb.
What the fuck?
There was just like a cat paw on a bone on a blanket.
What the fuck?
I, you know, It's one of those mysteries. You grow up in the country, you see weird mysteries involving wild animals.
Dude!
Did Fred Gwynn show up with a Maine accent and say, oh, come on, follow me, boy?
Yeah. No, you know what that just reminded me of was Neville's final story.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's like Crispy or whatever the goat was that went missing.
Yeah.
Crispy?
That was it. What was Milky. The goat's name?
Was it Milky?
Milky?
You guys are writing fan fiction right now about the name of this goat.
I think it was, in both cases, I think it was the Greys.
It probably was. Speaking of which, our loyal listeners, we don't condone this, but our listeners should know that 15 Cameras is out with the Neville doppelganger they put in to replace Neville.
Ah, fuck that.
Yeah.
I did
a dishonor. A dishonor to his legacy.
Yeah. Will yeah, I mean, the trailer, objectively speaking, I mean, the trailer looks it looks as good as you could make a trailer for that sort of movie, and yeah. It looks like a movie that Neville would have loved to be in. No Neville.
Neville would have loved to be in anything that they'd cast him in, I think.
That's true.
God bless. Like,
well, there's also like a really kind of off-color beat in the trailer where they show the Neville doppelganger and they're like, the slumlord, he's supposed to be dead or something like that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It's so
beyond the pale.
I mean, this is still completely a tangent, but it's so funny that like this movie that we all like pretty much hated other than his performance, we're now like sort of passionate about and are angry about like a shitty knockoff sequel like coming out without the original cast now. It's amazing the emotional attachments we've formed to at least a couple of these movies along this journey, despite hating the movie itself.
Yeah. Literally, now
as I was coming home from hanging out with a couple of friends to record this, someone who didn't know about the podcast was like, wait, you have a podcast? What do you do? And I kind of explained it like, oh, so what, like, what's the format of the show like? And I was like, yeah, you know, we review movies that are on Netflix. They usually wind up being really bad, but sometimes we talk to people who've been in the films or directed the film. I started talking about Neville. That's how strong of a hold he still has on me, that he's in the elevator pitch for our podcast.
Yeah, I mean, famously, I think I screwed 13 Cameras with Prejudice. I watched 13 Cameras. I was like, this is a horrible film. Who would do something like that? And now, fast forward, I'm like, recasting Neville is like recasting Wolverine. What the fuck are they doing?
I mean, I'm pretty sure I hated it too, but if I remember correctly, we were all on the same page that like this movie sucks, but whoever the fuck this actor is, like he's just bringing some incredible weird energy to it that no one else could really bring. I think we all had appreciation for him at least. It was kind of like it was like Jay. It was on that Jay level where we didn't all agree about 1920, but we were all like, yeah, Jay rules.
I mean, that's the whole attitude I've tried to bring into watching random movies or movies that aren't traditionally good, let's say. I like to find every movie has one thing in it that you're going to like.
I believe that
a very, very sparse number of movies have no redeemable quality. Every even the Open House being one of them.
You're welcome.
But I think besides the Open House, almost every movie I've seen for this show has had that one character or that one moment or that one decision or that one shot where I've been like, all right, that's cool. I'm gonna log that away as something cool.
What about the other famously bad one that I had the good fortune to miss, Polaroid?
I don't remember anything about Polaroid.
Okay.
Well, there goes your theory.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying I file away forever, but.
All right. Well, I'm glad we got down this rabbit hole from Dead Cats.
Yeah.
If I were like a film professor or something, I would make my students watch the worst movie. I'd be like, find 13 the worst cameras. Movie you can. I want you to assign the worst. You're going to pair up. You're each going to assign the worst movie you can think of to the other person. And then that person has to watch it. But then they have to come back with two things they liked about it.
I love that.
So one of my favorite horror personalities, who's also like a professor and a filmmaker, has said that every movie is someone's favorite movie except Microwave Massacre. And I apparently need to see Microwave Massacre.
I think just that quote being out there enough that you absorbed it means that there's someone who's like, my favorite movie is Microwave Massacre.
Probably. Hell, it could be me after I see it. Who knows? But I'm like, how can it really be like that bad? Because I watch a lot of bad shit and I still find something to be, if nothing else, enraged by. You know, I have a reaction to an emotion, but the yeah, I believe that there are probably some films out there that, wouldn't elicit anything from me except a feeling that I'd wasted my time.
Microwave Massacre.
Days, I think it's more common.
Microwave Massacre, produced and story by Craig Muckler. M-U-C-K-L-E-R. What a name.
So that's what the Muckler button on the microwave is for.
What the fuck is it? All right, well, this isn't a podcast about the Muckler button. This is the podcast for today, and today only, about It's Alive. I mean, what more can you say? They get the baby. It gets murked pretty spectacularly.
So he comes out of the drain, and he's holding his baby like, I'll have a child, and our guns are drawn, and he's like, I'm protecting this baby with my life. And now, like, I don't get it. I don't get it. Because what happens is, I think it looks like he throws the baby. Does he throw the baby, or does the baby leap?
Did she jump, or was she pushed? I don't know. You know, it's
I read it as a throw. Maybe it was supposed to be a leap, but they had to have the actor throw it.
Yeah, I would guess that based on
just the practicality of shooting.
Well, one of two things happens. Father, he either realizes he's in an impossible situation and everyone's going to shoot his baby, so he figures he's going to throw it and let them take out someone he sees as more evil, being the university professor, or the baby leaps at the university professor and they kill the baby. I think him throwing it is more interesting, but I agree it's probably not what they're going for.
I wrote that he threw the baby in my notes. So it looks like in the moment that was my read, and also he was crying.
Listen, we're just coming off a football season. The ruling on the field was a throw. We need conclusive evidence to overturn that call.
Well, but I think if he's throwing it, he's trying to like get it past the police, because it seems like he's trying to protect them. No,
he would you have think to, he's he just would have like to throw it like a football, because the police go on for, I mean, they may as well be an endless line of police, I think. I don't know. It's also possible that it leaps. But like I said, since they didn't have it, you know, how are they going to show it leaping? The actor would have to throw it. Right. So maybe it's just a low budget that we saw that. But either way, the baby lands on the university professor who wanted to vivisect the corpse of the baby for science. Yeah. Who, honestly, I mean, is that a bad thing to do? That's kind of what I would hope they would do if this happened.
I like how you said vivisect the corpse.
Yeah. Okay. And well, it might still be alive. Who knows? Anyway, and then the cops shoot at the baby. And they light up the professor in the process.
Oh, they blow the dead. Fuck out of both of them. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. Well, yeah.
Well done.
Professor dead, baby dead. That's your movie. Is there any falling action?
Yeah, we find out there's another one. Our baby has been born in Seattle. That's just like this one.
That's chilling, right? That's spooky.
Post-credit scene.
Yeah, there's not a post-credit scene, right?
No, I mean, it just has that like sequel setup post-credit scene type of energy.
No, I think I'm done watching post-credit scene. I've said this before, but like, I went to the movies. I went to see fucking Lisa Frankenstein. The credits roll, and I'm like, if there's anything else that this movie had to say, they could have put it in the movie.
Yeah,
we need to start walking out. I will give it to Marvel because that's their thing, and it's I think they use it well, but. I'm not sitting to the end for any other movie ever.
I've started just like sort of spoiling it for myself, where I'll like look it up in advance. Well, I don't always like spoil the exact content of the scene, but I definitely just pull out my phone and I'm like, is there a post-credit scene? And then I do the mental math of, after I see the movie, like, do I care enough to sit here and wait for it? And there have definitely been a few where I'm like, no, I don't give a shit. I'm leaving.
Or just wait until it shows up on YouTube, like, the next day.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Who gives a fuck? Yeah, there have been a few post-credit scenes or, like, mid-credit scenes on this podcast that I missed that you guys caught, actually. I can't remember the movies, but I know it's happened multiple times. And I've never felt
recently.
I've never felt like I missed a vital piece of information because, yeah, if it was vital, why wouldn't it be within the structure of the film itself?
It is very easy to tell on Netflix if there's going to be one because the fucking screen minimizes immediately and they start trying to sell you on the next thing unless there's something in the credits.
That happened to me. I was trying to sit with this movie for a little bit and then it's like, oh, minimized. Now here's the trailer for like some 2000s rom-com. Oh my God.
Or zom-com. And it was at this moment when it minimized that I realized, oh my God, this movie is rated PG. And, like, of course it was rated PG in 1974 because the rating system was different, but that rating has not been updated for the current era, which is something that I've never really considered before.
Mm.
That even in the streaming era, it's not like like, this should probably be, like, TVMA or something. If Netflix actually, like, if somebody actually, like, if they had, like, an ethics officer or something that, like, watched it and was like, yeah, you know, kids probably shouldn't see this alone. I find that kind of fascinating.
That's kind of funny. That, yeah, there's kids out there who are like, the rule in the house is you can watch anything you want from Netflix as long as it's PG or under.
Yeah, they watch this fucking movie.
Now they're watching It's Alive.
Hey, at least in one of the scenes, you think you're going to get blood and it's mostly milk. And, you know, it's tame in some ways.
And it's like, I would say a hard, because, I mean, there's all, obviously there's like the infamous examples of the movies that are the reason why they created the PG-13 rating, right? And it was mostly Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and Gremlins.
Gremlins, yeah.
But those are both movies that, while they're violent and dark, they're not as dark as this movie. They might be more violent, but like, this movie is a lot more dark than those. And those movies have a little bit of whimsy and fun and like familyness to them. And this is not a family movie at all.
Yeah, no,
even
I was allowed
Jaws
to see-
is more of a family movie than this.
I was allowed to see Gremlins when I was like 5 or 6 and I loved it. You know, yeah, it definitely scared me a couple of times, but I think that's good for kids.
They need to know there's something else out there that can get you.
Yeah, exactly. You gotta learn to watch your back at every turn. Anyway, that's It's Alive. I think we can put that one to rest. We can bury that dead
Well,
baby.
I do want to mention the sequels because I did see that they exist, and I am very.
I don't know the plots. I know nothing about them except that I saw the VHS covers as a child.
Well, I'll tell you the synopses as they are on Letterboxd.
I'm gonna guess that they did not follow through on the end of this one, and that 2 does not take place in Seattle.
I would say you're probably correct. Sequel, the direct sequel, is called It Lives Again.
Yeah,
good title, I guess. And it says the It's Alive baby is back, only now there are 3 of them.
Oh, fun.
maternity wards echo with a patter of tiny claws as more murderous baby face monsters are born. But rather than kill their monstrous offspring during delivery, cursed parents flee to secret incubation hideouts. Interesting.
Sounds and a then little there's, like the brood.
And then there's It's Alive 3, Island of the Alive. They do something worse than kill. They multiply. The mutant babies have been placed by court order on a deserted island.
Yes! I need to see this immediately.
Appalled by the cynicism and exploitation of the children by the legal system and the media, the man responsible for them leads an expedition to the island to free them. I think we can probably just skip to that one, right?
Yeah, definitely. The box set is under $30 on Amazon last time I looked, so we'll have to have a movie night here soon.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, what are we watching next time? I think it's the wheel's turn, and I kind of forgot the wheel existed because we haven't heard from it in so long.
The wheel is, it can be friend and it can be foe, but it's always there.
Is the wheel up to date?
The wheel is always up to date.
I feel like it's got got to have cobwebs on it at this point.
We're going to dust it off. We're going to dust it off. And we have every horror movie on Netflix loaded into a cyber wheel. Oh, my God. I forgot how I use this thing.
The only thing I love more than cyber sex is a cyber wheel.
Wow. All right. We're going to give this thing a spin and figure out what we're watching. We are going to watch Revenge of the Pont... God damn it.
Revenge of the Pontianak?
Revenge of the Pontianak. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation. This is a Malaysian film. Best we can do.
Okay.
And guess what? The genre of this film is chilling, horror, and love and obsession.
Oh. Okay.
All of my favorite things.
I wonder if it's related to the Kuntilana at all.
It's a film from Singapore, and it says a wedding in a Malaysian village leaves out one guest. A scorned vampire ghost bent on settling a secret score with the groom and anyone in her way.
That sounds pretty
rated
sick.
TV-14 for fear and for smoking.
Mm.
Oh my God, smoking hot vampire.
And it's 92 minutes. Yeah, nice. Baby.
Love to see it.
All right. Well, that'll be in 2 weeks. We'll watch Revenge of the Pontianak, which we'll let you know in 2 weeks if that's the correct pronunciation or not.
We probably won't know even after seeing the film. But yeah. We'll try. We'll try our best.
We'll figure it out.
We always do. All right, yes. Yeah, so in 2 weeks, we're going to, 2 weeks or so, we're going to watch Revenge of the Pontianak. Excited to get into that for every horror movie on Netflix. I've been Steven.
I've been Chris.
And I'm Patrick.
Bye.
Bye.